So good morning, I'm Janine Daggett. I'm filling in for Sharon this morning. And it is my pleasure to introduce Dr. Siebert, Joe Siebert, who's been here this week, offering many good things, contributing many good things. He is Emeritus Professor of Pathology in the School of Medicine at the University of Washington. Part of his graduate training and scientific research has been done in fields of evolutionary biology and physical anthropology. As a lifelong Christian, he has a deep interest in the interplay of religion and evolution. How many have been at all the sessions already, or at least one other session? Yeah, so you know. So this is the part three. And in addition, Dr. Siebert, we have a small token gift for you for all that you've been contributing. Holding cup. And thank you so much for all that you have been offering us. Good discussion. And maybe going away differently because of your talk.
Well,
so thank you.
Thank you so much.
Yeah.
So kind of. If our group remains small, I'm sort of thinking we would do some discussion today, and I've got some slides that sort of lead on to that discussion. But assuming the hordes don't show up in the next couple minutes, we might just be a little more casual, okay? And we can still use the slides to generate some conversation, okay? And I'll use the microphone for a couple minutes. Shall I do that?
Green light.
Okay. Let's see. Well, anyway, thank you so much for just everything this week. Yeah. I thought we'd start with a quiz since we're talking about God's creativity this week, right? So, what was God doing before the beginning of the universe?
Hanging out?
Yeah. And, you know, the title of this series has been In the Beginning, God, right? So, right, without question, God is in the universe from the beginning. And I don't know what happened at the beginning. You know, when I try to read about the Big Bang, those ideas are so enormous that I can't possibly understand it, right? The belief that there was nothing, and then in an instant, there was an entire universe, right? And there's quantum theory, quantum mechanics and all that, that and books and full of equations that say, yeah, this is how this stuff happened, but I can't possibly understand that, right? So, but I can't understand the magnitude of God either. So to me, the two go hand in hand, right? But what was God doing before the beginning of the universe? And the answer is cutting sticks, right? And this is, I'm surprised you don't know these answers because this is traditional Lutheran stuff, right? Martin Luther said it was to cane the people who ask such stupid questions. Okay, Martin Luther. Yeah. So with that, we should just turn off the computer and go for a hike, shouldn't we? Because maybe we're asking stupid questions. But here's what we talked about this week, right? This idea that God is creator, and we affirm this in our creeds, in our sacrament. We talked about Genesis as being a mythic story of creation, not true from a scientific perspective, and not true in those very small details, but true in the larger sense, right? The larger sense of how did we come to be? What does our relationship with God look like? When that relationship breaks down, what does that look like? God's creation is ongoing. Evolution can be observed. Evolution occurs by different mechanisms and by different rates. It can be studied in many different ways, but it needs to stand up to scrutiny, right? We said mathematics, chemistry, physics, biology, geography, geology, genetics, all of those disciplines tell us some things about evolutionary patterns. And those should all kind of fit together, right? They should all make sense. If something truly happened 100 million years ago, then maybe several disciplines can inform us to that fact at the same time. right? Like the police detective that goes to the crime scene. All of those different observations, right, and conclusions should make sense, right? If a crime was committed by a certain person on a certain time, right, the data should line up. Yeah. So that's what we talked about this week. But I thought we would now talk about, yesterday we talked about, you know, the science of how do we study evolution, but now what does that mean for us going forward? So I thought I'd review just a couple of things briefly from yesterday because I want to make sure that we really have those major points. But here's the National Science Teachers Association. Evolution is a major unifying concept. Evolution should be taught as part of scientific training, but also evolution should be emphasized for scientific literacy to create a well-informed citizenry, right? Do we have a well-informed citizenry these days?
No, we don't.
Nora tells a story. Your friend works in the White House, in the science division in the White House.
Science and technology.
Science and technology. And she says
that since the Obama administration went away, her entire department has decreased by 90%. They still have 10% of their staff.
Yeah. So the science division in the White House that advises the president has been decreased by 90%, right? So, yeah. And this is obviously happening in other divisions too, but that's firsthand information, isn't it, from someone who works in the department.
Not an urban myth. That's
not an urban myth. This is from someone who works in the department. Yeah. I can tell you that the NIH, the National Institutes of Health, was ravaged under Ronald Reagan. And I had friends who worked for the NIH, and the morale just plummeted, and the dollars weren't there. And when that happens, when the NIH does not have the dollars, it can't give grants to scientists who are working on diseases, right? So you want to cure cancer, you have to have dollars to do the research. Yeah, so I emphasized for a scientific illiteracy. The guy who was in the running to be Secretary of the Navy, right, just a couple of months ago, was going around publicly saying he did not believe in evolution. And this was going to be Secretary of the Navy, so I don't suppose the Secretary of the Navy has to know very much about evolution, but you would hope this person knows about science, right, and is able to take contemporary science and use it as he would need to, right? So, and I'm sure we can multiply that all across the government at whatever the levels are. So this being a Lutheran camp, I thought we should talk about how the Lutherans, you know, have played a role in evolution, right? So this is a funny story, but it sort of shows you how science works or doesn't work. But a colleague of mine had gone to school in Pennsylvania. A friend of his was a professor at Gettysburg Seminary, right? The Lutheran Seminary in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania. And the plumbers were working on a problem out in the side yard and uncovered this bone. Well, now, we know that the Gettysburg Seminary was an important hospital site during the battle at Gettysburg, right? The three-day battle in the Civil War. Seminary Ridge, right? You know about Seminary Ridge. That was the Lutheran Seminary, right? And so it was a Union hospital at that time. So they thought maybe this was a bone from a soldier, right? It could be an important find. So the professor in Gettysburg mailed this bone to my colleague in Seattle, who had virtually no interest in it. But he gave it to me, and so, you know, I thought about it and thought about it. Got an x-ray of it, which shows absolutely nothing. So I wondered what this was. A friend of mine is a paleontologist at the University of Washington, so I took the bone over to him and said, "Don, we've got this fragment of a bone," and I told him this long story about Seminary Ridge and, you know, Union soldiers and all, and he looked at it and he said, "It's a metapodal bone."
Say that again?
Metapodal bone. So it's right up there at the top,
okay,
Spelled out for you. So he said, "Oh yeah, this is," and he knew instantly, "this is a metapodal bone." And I said to him, "Well, Don, the human doesn't have a metapodal bone." He said, "No, but the pig does."
Pig.
Oh,
Okay, the pig does. So this is just a bone from a pig that somehow got into the earth outside one of the buildings at Gettysburg Seminary. So it's a meaningless story. I've just wasted 5 minutes of your time. But this is kind of how science works, isn't it? And if someone erroneously called that a, you know, a phalanx from a person, you could build a story, right? That here was an amputation from a poor Union soldier and so on and so on. And your conclusion would be absolutely wrong. Okay. So without question, this sort of thing happens around the world. People find fossils and make mistakes with them. So that happens. Okay. All right. So here's our son. I just have to show this picture. Here's our little boy when he was, how old is he, 2.5? This is Matthew. And Matthew came to us when he was very young. This is my wife, Linda, sitting back here. How old was Matthew? Maybe four, five years old. When he came to us. And he sort of whispered, but he said, I don't believe in Santa Claus. And he said, you know, and his older sister is in the next room, so we got to be quiet about this. What do you mean you don't believe in Santa Claus? Why don't you believe in Santa Claus? He said, because I know reindeer don't fly.
Okay.
He said, I know reindeer don't fly. So, right, there's fact and there's fantasy, right? And evolution is fact, and no matter what you want to say about it, or really, I'm beating up on the book of Genesis all week long, right? Right? But Genesis says things that are not scientifically true. That's okay. But here's a clear thinker, right? A clear thinker. And he's got a view of what reality is, and so this other story just doesn't match up with reality, right? Some people say that, I've heard this quote, that one of the big reasons people are leaving the church is because the church doesn't have a grip on reality. That's very harsh, and I don't know that we would debate that, right? As church people, we would debate that forever. But still, I guess in the back of our minds, we have to ask ourselves, you know, at some level, maybe in adult education anyway, we have to talk about reality, right? And conclude, I hope, that reality does not need to, meaning scientific reality, does not need to threaten our faith. Hmm. So, this is what we do not want to see, right? You know, this is a good one, huh? This is on every bulletin board in every scientific laboratory, isn't it? So when our engineers are stumped, right, they can pray, they can surely pray, but, you know, when they're designing that airplane, we want them to have facts, don't we, and testable facts, right? So prayer helps, but we don't want to insert miracles into our scientific equations, right? So there's a place for religion in our lives, a place for science in our lives. So we talked some about shared characters yesterday. You know, I showed that picture of the tiger with a little domestic cat sitting next to it. Said, anatomically, we share these characters, and this suggests to us that there had to be a common ancestor if different species can be so similar. So there's the gorilla. And so when we share characters, we can share form, meaning anatomy, or we can share function. So then I made the point that you can use the same anatomy book to study the monkey, the chimpanzee, the human. Use the same book. And I own the book, and I've done this in the laboratory. Same muscles, same bones. Their dimensions are different, aren't they? Some bones are longer, shorter, muscles might be longer, whatever. But still, the same basic pattern is there. So the evolutionary biologist says, well, the reason that the anatomic pattern is the same is because all of these animals derive from a common ancestor sometime in the past. I don't know if you know about the porcine heart valves, right? You can take a heart valve out of a pig and put it into a human, and it works. See, so I think we share form and we share function. I mean, anatomically, the pig looks a whole lot different than we do, of course, but immunologically, that valve will work in our own heart. It will not be rejected. So we talked yesterday about genetic relationships, and I just talked about this one protein. This protein is identical in the chimpanzee and the human, and the chances that that identity could arise from chance is 1 out of 10 to the 93rd power, right? So 10 with 93 zeros after it, right? So this is impossible for the protein, all the chemical compounds in that protein to be identical from the chimp and the human. Impossible unless the chimp and the human came from the same source. And so I thought up an example of that, which I think is pretty good. Imagine your pastor walk around with a briefcase. Maybe not.
Mine has a backpack. He's young.
A backpack. So briefcase / backpack. And so you walk into the church with your pastor, and it turns out you're both carrying identical briefcases, right? And so let's see here how the story goes. You open up these two briefcases, and you know they're 99% identical, 99.9% identical, right? You got identical briefcases, identical contents. What does this tell you?
You and me are identical.
Are identical, or maybe you're a little bit too codependent, right? If you've got, if you're carrying the same briefcases, the same stuff in a briefcase, but maybe you've just both been to the same convention, right? And you picked up the same freebies right there, giving away briefcases, and right, you went around to all of the booths and you picked up all the free stuff, and it happens that you've got identical stuff. So, but it means there's some commonality in your background, right? If you both have identical briefcases. So now you see, imagine proteins, right? If the proteins are identical, or if the skeletal muscles and the bones are identical, you came from the same place at some time in the past. So we talked some about overlap in the fossil record, right? So, and I'll show you that graph in just a minute. But one species does not necessarily evolve directly into the next species. So evolution, in most cases, probably not linear, but instead of sort of like a tree or a bush with species that split off from common ancestors, okay? And so by studying all of those different creatures and tabulating what are the similarities and differences, you can kind of guess at what point they split off from each other. So I showed this one yesterday, right? The Australopithecus are those old ape-like creatures in Africa, and there were a number of them, right? Robustus is the one that Louis Leakey discovered. But at the same time these Australopithecines were coming along, there was Homo habilis, or the handyman, who was early human, starting to make stone tools. Then Homo erectus, a little more robust, a little bit larger, presumably a little more intelligent version of Homo, and then finally Homo sapiens, probably almost 500,000 years ago. But you see how they overlap, and these dates, right? We talked about how you develop dates from all of these things. So those dates are thought to be accurate. They're used. We can, as we get more specimens and develop more techniques for dating, why maybe those dates would get a little more accurate. I mean, right? It's when they say 4 million years ago, it's probably 4 million plus or minus a couple hundred thousand or something, right? So there's some variation in those estimates. But you see those animals overlap, and you've got Australopithecus robustus living in Africa at the same time as early Homo came along, okay, the same time. This was revolutionary when it was realized that these overlap, right? So you've got early humans, and you've got these ape-like creatures, these Australopithecines, who look really, they look a lot like apes, but they also look a lot like humans. They're existing at the same time in Africa. So it's just amazing. And then there's the Neanderthal out there, right? The Neanderthal was just sort of a short-lived guy, I think 50,000, 60,000, 70,000 years or so they survived. And then they went extinct. Not exactly clear why they went extinct, but then Homo sapiens showed up just recently. So it's just fascinating, isn't it? When you think of evolution, think of a bush, a very, I think, a tangled, complex bush, rather than just a straight line. So I thought what we would do today is to take that information that we've considered over the last couple of days about evolution and say, well, what does that mean? The theologians tell us evolution is ongoing. What does that mean from a faith perspective? Okay, do you know this guy, Teilhard de Chardin, was a French priest and a paleontologist. He made this point. The fact is that creation has never stopped. The creative act is one huge continual gesture drawn out over the totality of time. It is still going on, and incessantly, even if imperceptibly, the world is constantly emerging a little farther above nothingness. Wow, this idea that I think creation, however you define it, whether you define it as biological change or change in our souls, right? This is ongoing. And this point is made by a number of other people too, but what do you think of that? Do you buy that? Do you have thoughts about that, experiences?
I do. I was just chatting with this professor who gave the multimedia presentation last night on wildfires, and he was telling me about DNA that humans have and that we share them with some species of trees that are DNA that kind of sit dormant until they're needed, until they're called upon for adaptation to a new environment. I forget the word he used. It was something like ectogenetics or
epigenetics.
Epigenetics. Uh-huh. I hadn't heard that word before, but it was interesting to me. And so that would be part of evolution, would it not? If we have DNA, but it doesn't really change. He says it's already there. It's just that it's not needed yet. But when we do need it, it will be called upon.
So genes can be turned on and off, can't they?
And a huge part of the DNA that's, even for human, that's been sequenced, they don't have any purpose, no, that they can see. There's no protein they develop or anything. And so a large portion of our DNA is junk, in a way. But it's not really until they find a reason for it.
Right. Sure.
There's a book written, I think it's called The Swerve, and I don't know who the author is, but anyway, it's about how there'll be a direct line of DNA, and then suddenly something happens to one of the little cells, and it takes, and it's passed on. Usually something happens to one of your cells, and it's not hereditary. Now and then, one is, and it's all part of this ongoing process of evolution.
Yeah. Yeah. I haven't studied Chardin for a long time, but he was pretty much an optimist, thinking that this sort of progressiveness in behind creation, that things will eventually get better, farther above nothingness. Just curious that I would think that there's got to be other viewpoints. I think it's Carl Sagan who thought that the reason we don't have any contact with other species from outer space is that they eventually evolve to a point they destroy themselves. that they are not rising above nothingness, but actually become, there's something sick in them that eventually, cannot keep progressing, will eventually be destructive.
Yeah.
And I don't know, if there's anything in the genetic field that has any thoughts about this, or is it, just randomness of selection. Survival of the fittest, but then eventually is that fittest always, quote, better?
Yeah, we're able to make a nuclear bomb and the gorillas can't.
Right.
And so we're superior to them, right? Yeah. The genetic thing, I think we share an awful lot of genetic information with corn, for example. So, that's wild. We were talking about sharing genes or whatever, or proteins, whatever, with apes. My heavens, we share things with corn, right? So, evolution goes back an awful lot farther than what we've talked about this week, right? Genes can be turned on and can be turned off, and there can be environmental causes for that. Yeah.
And we share jumping genes like corn did too.
Yeah.
It was found in corn, but then later found in us.
And a lot of our genetic makeup, as you say, is junk, or at least we don't yet know what it's for, right? Yeah. But this idea that God's creation is not static, I think, is what will stick with today. So there's the first draft of the Ten Commandments. Yahweh or the highway. So God is not static, right? Things are still happening, always happening. Here's Dietrich Bonhoeffer, right? 1937. God does not wish to rule over an unchanging world, for that would be a dead world. It's been said that if God created a perfect world and insisted that world be perfect, God would simply have reinvented God. And that would have been just boring as can be, huh? Yeah. Is that so? Is an unchanging world a dead world? It's kind of comforting, right? You would just know what tomorrow's going to look like.
Doesn't stop it moving.
There are some societies that are more resistant to change than other societies, and it's a dead world. It's a dead society. I'm especially thinking of languages because that's what my business was when I was working. There are some languages that are spoken today that are the same as they were 1,000 years ago because they've been very resistant to taking on new words, new sounds, and other languages like English or Japanese, and we're continually changing.
It's true, isn't it, that if the language changes because your society is changing, right? I mean, a word like internet, we didn't have that word 50 years ago, did we? All sorts of words like that. Yeah. One of my professors said, it's not the survival of the fittest, it's the survival of the filthiest. Right? She meant those who had strong immunity, right? If you had been exposed to lots and lots of bacteria and lots of viruses and dealt with that successfully, you're more likely to succeed.
Those of us who grew up on farms
would be exposed to a lot, huh?
Yeah. Have a special immunity.
And you've done just fine, right?
Yeah. 7 years.
Yeah. Well, anyway, Dietrich Bonhoeffer, right? 1937. Here's a poem just published a couple of years ago. Do you know W.S. Merwin was poet laureate, wasn't he, from the U.S.? But as they were leaving the garden, one of the angels bent down to them and whispered, I am to give you this as you are leaving the garden. I do not know what it is or what it is for, what you will do with it. But this really is what God has done, right? Is turned over the world to us and say, here's the world. I don't know what you'll do with it. I thought that poem caught that just beautifully, to think of angels whispering to people, to Adam and Eve as they were leaving the garden, right? Yeah. What you will do with it. So how do we respond to God's ongoing creation? So Genesis maybe gives us some hints, doesn't it? Genesis 1 and Genesis 2 are different, right? The two creation stories are expressed differently, right? And some of the wording is different. Let them have dominion or till the earth and keep it. So this is Dietrich Bonhoeffer again from a book he wrote in 1937. He says, at times we do not rule, instead we are ruled. Technology is the power with which the earth seizes hold of humankind and masters it. And I was caught by his use of those words, technology seizes hold of humankind, huh? True? So it's fun to read different translations of Genesis 1 and Genesis 2, right? But one of the translations says, subdue the earth, right? Subdue the earth. And we've largely done that. with the bulldozer or whatever, we can subdue the earth. But I like the wording from Genesis 2 instead, right? Till the earth and keep it. So what should that word dominion mean to us in the world? So you grew up on a farm, so you treated the land with great love and great respect. Because it was your livelihood, right? Yeah.
And our animals, too.
And your?
Your animals.
Sure, oh, sure. Sure.
Chickens.
Yeah. This is your livelihood, isn't it? But it's land and creatures that you're going to care for. It's dear to you, and you're going to care for it, huh?
Well, there's always a tension between protecting it. So if we are co-creators, then there's a sense in which, well, are human beings supposed to take the materials and see what we can do with it? But some of those things we do with it are helpful and good, and some are not. And so to have dominion, I mean, is to not mess it up, and on the other hand, to go with it, go at it. And human beings have this opportunity to be co-creators with God, which is quite a privilege. What a responsibility.
Yeah.
You agree?
Yeah. Sure. That phrase, till the earth and keep it, obviously is saying use the earth, right? Use the earth. We have to use the earth, don't we?
Well, I'm thinking of the issue of genetically altered food,
crops.
GMOs. And maybe the good they've done is provided a whole lot more food for in places where they needed food, but it's also created almost this like Frankenstein monster that is out of our control. And, I think there are a lot of things in this world that start out maybe being good and then we overdo it or it gets into the wrong hands and it's a mess.
Well, and when the companies give that genetically modified food to other countries, they say, we'll give you these seeds, but eventually that big corporation may end up taking over. I can't think of the name of it right now.
Monsanto.
But, you know, one of the things, my son works in this field, and his premise with GMO is that there are ways in which it becomes the monster. But he said, for the most part, the reality is that it actually not have that kind of monster effect. Because it's a question of stewardship of the DNA. And I think that's where the dominion comes in, is that the question is, are you going to lord it over and use an extraction mentality around creation? Or are you going to have a stewardship function that says that we are intimately engaged in this creation because we are part of it? And that changes how one then looks at Genesis 1, Genesis 2, but also every other creation story that comes out of Scripture. And so I just, you know, I think it's important that lording over it and becoming an extraction, saying, I'm going to take everything I can get out of this and then leave alone. I spend a lot of time in Alaska, and that's one of the things that you work with the Western cultures that are constantly extracted from, and then said, oh, when we're all done extracting everything you get, leave, which is part of the culture. The other side is the native people had a different framework because they knew that they were going to be here and that the generation, next generation, was going to need that forest, that salmon, that seal, that beaver, whatever it might be.
Yeah.
And so those two values were really in conflict all the time.
Yeah. Sure.
And, you know, a lot of this comes down to economics. Is good economics to take care of your land and your animals and your wild animals even, you know? That can't help but be part of dominionism. You know, if you're a good king of the land, which dominion means, then you're going to think about future generations, and to do that you have to care for the land and the animals.
Yeah, thank you. So another quote, the church has too frequently adopted the world's view of dominion, that is, demonstrated power and self-interested exploitation. We have too often treated creation as an enemy requiring forceful control of an inexhaustible resource to be used for our pleasure. I mean, here we are in Holden Village, right, Railroad Creek, and boy, we know about the mine. Not to say that copper extraction wasn't important, but it has long-standing effects, doesn't it? And he goes on, the recognition of our position as God's image bearers should make the church a powerful force for environmental stewardship, yet the church has remained largely silent. This was written some time ago, right?
93.
So that's a while ago. So I don't know, do we buy this now?
Well, Francis has come out with Laudato Si, which is an environmental statement for the first time from the Catholic Church.
Yeah. The batteries have probably just gone dead on this, so that's that. Yeah, and so, I mean, the ELCA has social statements, right? That get at genetics, for example, they have a social statement. Yeah. From my reading, I'm learning that even more conservative denominations are getting concerned about environmental issues, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's there's a movement too with sustainability and when it comes to food and just the, you know, at our church we have the beehives, you know,
In India, northern India?
No.
Bihar?
Bees.
Hives.
Oh, bees.
Bees. And the garden. So there are a lot of churches have that kind of thing is, and some of it is used for food preparation for some of the church-related, making soups and things like that for particular groups of people. I know people that do that. But anyway, there's a focus on sustainability, I think, when it comes to food and CSA boxes and clean greens kinds of access to food and how that plays out in our culture, in cities. And,
sure.
So I see that.
There is a large emerging church movement around eco-faith work.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at new churches that are emerging in the ELCA, I mean, I would say at least half of them have a dimension to them, which is tied to the way land is being used, how food is being produced, and people are becoming not just aware but advocates within the system, whether that be protests or political advocacy. That's a very, very common theme through many of the emerging churches in the ELCA right now.
Well, and that's good news, isn't it? That's mm-hmm. That's tremendous news. Yeah. Our church is starting to think about putting solar panels on our roof. We've got a big, flat roof, right? Lots of room for solar. Yeah, so what we're getting at here, right? If God is creator, then God's creation is sacramental. So it's just very legitimate for churches and people of faith to be concerned about the environment. So I looked up these extinction events. You know, there have been these major extinction events millions and millions of years ago. But that first one, 439 million years ago, 86%, I guess, of all creatures died in that extinction event. And then this late Jurassic, 75% of all animal species disappeared. So there have been these major extinction events throughout geologic history, history of the world. And as we read now, right, where some people say we're in a sixth major extinction event now, right? Some call it the Holocene, and recently I've seen it called the Anthropocene, right? Because humans are involved in this. And the extinction rate is 1,000 times what it was estimated to be in 1900, right? 1,000 times the extinction rate. And due to human causes, right? Yeah, which is why it's called the Anthropocene. And look at this, just since 1880, six birds have gone extinct in North America. I had question marks beside ivory-billed woodpecker because there was, right, a little excitement that there might have been one or so in a marsh in Arkansas, but I think that's not so. But those birds have gone extinct in North America, right, in the last 100 years or so. Yeah. So, can humans alter evolution?
Well, you have to also count in humans have been breeding for years, for centuries. You know, both plant and animals. We've changed them to fit our needs.
Yeah, it's true, isn't it? Yeah. And we made this point with Charles Darwin, right, that he must have known that you can breed animals on the farm and. And then he asked the question, can this also happen in nature? Yeah. Right, but the beaver and the buffalo were nearly extinct, weren't they? They were just tracked or hunted almost to extinction. California condor, right, was down to six individuals. And those six individuals were all trapped and bred in captivity. I think now there's over 90 California condors, right? And we have friends who went to California and saw one flying, so, yeah.
But how much you sit there when you go down and breed six pairs or whatever, the genetic pool is so slim, how do you know it's going to survive long?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, so if there were 90 right now, why they all came from six individuals, didn't they? Yeah, so yeah. They share the genetics of those six individuals. Yeah, so I guess you hope that those six were healthy, huh? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But people have been finding malformed frogs around the U.S., right? I think the general population of frogs is way down, right? Way decreased. But some frogs are malformed. I think there's toxins in the water, huh?
And turtles, too.
Turtles
have been malformed.
We don't have bees down there, and I'm pretty concerned about bees worldwide.
There's been tremendous concern about that, isn't there? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I say a lot of concern about bees. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I should add bees to the list, shouldn't I? Yeah.
Well, I haven't seen or heard a bullfrog yet up here. Yet my kids used to catch a bullfrog at Holden.
Oh,
they
Holden?
Were little, come show them, and they were always trying to find bigger ones. And then, of course, they'd gently take them back to where they found them. And I haven't seen one. Oh.
Where did they find them?
They were kind of by the river. And they were big. Because I woke up laying out there one time and found one on my chest.
Brought to you by your kids?
Yes.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. Huh. Well, you know, luckily there's a lot of environmental studies going on in Railroad Valley, right? Railroad Creek Valley. So, yeah. And hopefully we'll get some answers as to, you know, what the mine runoff is like and so on. Yeah. Yeah. You know about the Yellowstone wolves, right? This is an interesting story, right? There were no wolves, and since there were no wolves, why the number of deer and elk increased, and they didn't move, right? The elk and deer did not have to migrate around. They could just sit tight and enjoy their meadow or whatever, but they really just destroyed the ecosystem. And so, and there are photographs, right, that show this beautifully. So when the wolf was reintroduced, that caused the deer and the elk to be moving. And as they moved, all of a sudden, then the aspen could come back, and you had less erosion, right, and less siltation in the streams. So pretty good example of how you can alter one species and affect the whole ecosystem. So what can we do to preserve God's creation? And we touched on this, didn't we, a couple of days ago. Well, last night the gentleman talking about forest fires, right? He got at that really good, didn't he, about preserving forests, making forests more healthy, making sure that this forest survive, and that if we live in the forest, that we survive too. Huh?
And that requires, that shift that he's talking about, requires a huge mental shift for people who have seen logging and other kinds of protective means. I mean, that was, for me, it was a very new integrated concept of how we have to use nature to help manage the forest itself in ways that suppression had always been the theme previously.
Yeah, we always fought fires, didn't we? And what do you say, we were 95-97% successful in fighting fires? Yeah. Well, a few days ago we had a talk about fire ecology, and we brought in some of these lodgepole pine cones, which were all closed up. Were you here for that? And she heated up some lodgepole pine cones with a blowtorch, just actually zapped them with a blowtorch outside, actually. Brought those pine cones in, and then the heat had sort of melted away the resin, right, that holds the cone closed. The needles opened up a little bit. I don't know, they're not called needles, but whatever.
Racks.
The what?
Racks.
Racks, okay. Opened up, and then she was able to just tap them on a piece of paper, and you could see the seeds just pop out onto the paper, right? But yeah, it requires fire. Interesting that he was making that point that if a fire starts by natural means, maybe you just let it go, right? You protect the town, of course, protect houses, but otherwise let it go and let it burn out the brush and so on. Yeah. Have you walked out to 10 Mile Falls, out that trail? It's gorgeous out there, isn't it? I mean, there's devastation from the fire, but my gosh, the fireweed is gorgeous, and there's openness out there and sunlight, and there's a lot of bird life out there, and the bear is having a good time out there too. I know that, and we've seen deer, so yeah.
Yeah. Joe, are you going to mention overpopulation?
Well, not in that slide, I guess, but... So why don't you go with that?
Well, I've just, for the longest time, thought that that's the issue. How do we preserve God's creation? There are simply too many of us, or well, not right, not yet, but the earth has a carrying capacity, I think. I don't think we can continue on this growth pattern that we are now.
Yeah, no, I don't either.
I remember years ago there was a big movement, remember zero population.
Yeah. Yes. Mm-hmm.
I think I even sent money to whatever that organization was. And I don't hear talked about so much anymore. Maybe it's out of respect for various cultures, or I don't know.
Well, Japan's facing the opposite issue right now.
Right.
That they aren't replacing generations, and I think that there is a question of balance with that, that we have to really be intentional about. That if you go to that extreme, because there's some countries in Europe where that's happening in terms of specific populations, specifically white populations in Europe. Some of the European countries have stayed very, very flat, where other populations have continued to grow very, very dominant.
And I don't think they're really friendly toward immigration in Japan, are they? I could be wrong about that.
Mm-hmm. It's like that in Europe, you know, you think about countries that have had such low population growth, and now they have a lot of immigrants coming in generally with families and cultures that would probably start to grow the population. And so, yeah, it's interesting to think about how that would change the face of a lot of those countries.
I use that word balance just a lot in my own thinking, right? How do we balance these things, right? Yeah.
There's two ways of thinking about that, and one of them is associated with many religions, that the more children you have, well then, the more chance that some of them will survive to take care of you in your old age.
Yes. Yes.
And so people have a lot of babies. But I remember in Latin America seeing a poster, one where the family had about six kids and the other where the family had two. And in the background, with six kids, it showed a real impoverished situation. And with the two kids, they had a nice house and a nice car. And and so it kind of boiled down to using the economic argument to keep the number of kids down.
Yeah, yeah. And in evolutionary terms, it's called K selection and R selection, where some, like a fish, will have, 1,000 eggs, and a chimpanzee will have one offspring. Right? So there's two ways of going at this. If you want your species to survive, maybe from an evolutionary perspective, maybe you reproduce a lot, knowing that the mortality is going to be very, very high. But yeah, but humans, of course, had that option of producing a lot or a few, but when you produce a few, you can invest more of your time, more of your resources in the few offspring.
I'm reminded that the family, the affluent family with two kids, is using a whole lot more of the world's resources than the family that maybe, even in our country, the family that has more kids and less.
So it be, couldn't it?
It's very uneven.
Yeah.
As far as, I mean, as the privileged people in industrialized countries, we bear a huge responsibility for this, for what's happened and how to fix it. So I think it's more than population. I think population's important, but I remember the zero population growth too, and it was a lot of it. Besides only replacing yourself, but it was sending, you know, birth control devices to India, and you know, there was just a lot of putting our own values and our own methods on people in other parts, with other cultures and other ways of life.
Well, that was a lot of the research then that was found in India, is once they had better health care, maternity care, that if they could ensure that they would have children that would grow to be teenagers, then they had less children.
Right.
And
they did better. Issue.
And they did
better
much better. Because they weren't afraid that they were going to lose their children. Mm-hmm.
But it's the method that we Westerners often use. It's not so good.
Right.
So Nora, I don't see a population on that. I've got to add bees to the other side.
Right.
Right. I add a population to this one. Mm-hmm. Right. Got to remember to do that. Do you know what? There's an organization in Seattle called Earth Ministry, which is just a neat organization. So earthministry.org would be that website, and Linda and I belong to that organization. But it's an organization that takes faith and says, how do we apply faith to our environment, right? So a pretty good list there of things to think about when we think of God's creation. And we're surely reminded of all of that here at Holden. And Earth Ministry sponsors something called Green Congregations, right? Your congregation can get this green congregation status, but it means you'll be very very thoughtful about the energy use that you have, the kind of light bulbs you use. You probably promise not to use styrofoam in your church potlucks and so on, you know. But it's a nice concept for the church to think about. If we're going to be stewards of God's creation, how do we do this as a congregation? So I think we're coming up on an hour, and we can have more conversation, or we can go to lunch. But I only have about two slides. But you know, this is an unfolding world, isn't it? It just is. It goes on and on. And I think God, I think Jesus calls us to be thinking about the future, right? Isaiah should have the last word, don't you think? Mm-hmm. Isaiah should have the last word. Right? Do not remember the former things or consider the things of old. I am about to do a new thing. Yeah. Right. So we're watchful about tomorrow. We pray about today and we pray about tomorrow. Thank you for sticking through three of these sessions. It's been a tremendous pleasure for me. I got a mug out of it, so.
All right.